This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Film historian and critic David Thompson is our guest this afternoon. The author of many books on film, he's recently completed a work that looks at 1,000 movies from A to Z, from Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein to Antonioni's Zabriskie Point. The book's title? Have You Seen? A Personal Introduction to 1,000 Films. The book's subtitle describes the book further, noting it includes masterpieces, oddities, guilty pleasures, and classics, with just a few disasters. Have You Seen is a companion volume to his A Biographical Dictionary of Film, published in 1975 and updated in 2004. It's known as one of the best reference works on film. It is a wonderful book, Have You Seen? Great fun to spend time with. I've been looking at it now over a couple of days now, reading the work of a man who spent his life watching, thinking about, and writing about film. And that's a reason why I'm also looking forward to reading another book recently completed by David Thompson. Our guest has recently completed a memoir, just published. Its title is Try to Tell the Story. The reviews are good. Jonathan Yardley concluded his review by saying it is a fine book, modest and self-effacing, but also forthright and uncompromising. Try to Tell the Story tells the story of Thompson's growing up in London during the war. Listeners, I invite your phone calls for film historian and critic David Thompson. I invite your questions and comments. Here are the phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455, 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Both the books, Have You Seen? A Personal Introduction to 1,000 Films and Try to Tell the Story, both these recent books by our guest David Thompson, published by Knopf. David Thompson, it's so good to talk with you again. How are you?
I'm very well, and it's so good to be back with you, and I hope everyone's well in Illinois.
I hope everyone is well in California.
Two states
with big problems.
Yeah.
Well, tell us how it was that you selected the 1948 film Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein for the first entry.
Well, there's a real story behind this, so give me a few minutes, will you? The book is arranged in alphabetical order, and as I was doing the work, I built the list of how many films and what the films would be, and I started showing it to a number of people, friends, whose judgment on film I respect. And I showed it to one friend, a man named Michael Barker, who is very big at Sony Classics, a film distributor. And he looked at the list, and he said, "Now, David, I turned to the first page of this huge 1,000-page book. I always open a book at the first page and try to read the first page. And the way you've got it, the first film is Abe Lincoln in Illinois." Mm-hmm. And that's how it had come out alphabetically. And I said, "Yes, that's right. That's the first one." And he said, "Do you really love that film?" And I said, "Well, no, I don't love it. I respect it." He said, "Are you crazy about that film?" "No," I said. And he said to me, "The first page in this book should set the tone. It should be passionate, and it should have something to do with the real nature of movies, which is wonderful, but often trashy." And I knew he was right. I knew he was right. I knew that that first film had to be something that hit people in the eye, that was a surprise. And Abe Lincoln in Illinois is a worthy film, but it doesn't meet that bill, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So we went to Leonard Maltin's film guide, which is probably the most thorough alphabetical guide, and we looked for something that we could put in at the beginning, and found Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein. And with one voice, we said, "That's it." Because Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, in many ways, is not as good. Certainly not as serious a film as Abe Lincoln in Illinois. But It is something only the movies could have done. The idea of these two comics being pursued by and pursuing Frankenstein. This, we're into movie folklore totally. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy. It's ridiculous. And we know it's going to make us laugh. And it has something raw and primitive, but authentically of the movies and the idea that we go to have a good time.
Mm.
And for me, it was a great opening because it's fun.
Yeah, it is fun. And Abe Lincoln in Illinois is tucked in there, too, at the top. You did it both. You got both of them in there.
Yeah.
Well, there's an entry, North by Northwest.
Yes.
And in that book, in that entry, in that review, you say you're at a point where you'd rather have a great screwball comedy than a profound tragedy.
Well, you know, I am, and perhaps it's true of this time too,
mm-hmm.
because. We know the cinema can be very solemn, very serious, very artistic. It can be very important. But there's something about the movies, which I think everybody has always known, that they are there to delight and entertain us and console us. And they do very well in bad times. And just as the movies have never had a better audience than during the Depression and the Second World War. Audiences were bigger all over the world. So it looks now as if with hard times here again, box office figures have started going up, you know. More people are going to the movies at the moment. It's still a cheap form of entertainment, and it's still a place where you think you may be able to have your mind taken off your troubles and all the bills you can't pay.
Yeah. And we've got a listener who wants to talk with you. I'm going to get there in just a second. But the fun thing about the entry North by Northwest is that you say, you know what, this movie is a screwball comedy.
Well, I think it is. And I think that, you know, Hitchcock was always a comic underneath the suspense. He loved humor. And North by Northwest, if you look at it now, 40 years, 50 years after it came out, it really plays as a comedy. There's an adventure in it, and the adventure is very silly, but it's enough to keep us going along. But the great quality of the film is in the humor, the absurdity. And I find, as I grow older, and I have not found a way to stop growing older, that I like those films more and more. I think that generally the Academy, for instance, the Academy has always looked down on comedies. And I think it's a great pity because I think that one of the abiding strengths in American filmmaking, particularly from Chaplin to today, has been in the comedies.
Well, let's take a call now from a listener in Indiana on line 4. Hello.
I certainly agree with you about the comedies as being more important than a lot of other films that people usually put in their books. Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, I remember seeing it as a child, and I would put it in the book because it's got all the bad boys in it. And that's
good
not
point.
That's so usual, you know, in the earlier films like that.
That's a great point, and I love it because it's sort of Abbott and Costello. In a way, they go to the movies because they meet a lot of movie characters. And I think that quality in the movies, that they feed off themselves, it's always been there. The other thing is I think that Abbott and Costello are one of those couples like Laurel and Hardy. They've dated a little bit, but not too much.
Yeah.
You can still look at them and just... You can fall about laughing, and that's a wonderful achievement.
Yes, I don't know if it was legal or not. I haven't made any money on it, but I did a lot of taping of Turner Classic Movies. Finally got back to their cycle, you know, the cycle after about 7 years. I got 1,400 tapes
Oh, good for you.
VHS. Most of them are shorter films. So I've got like six tapes on one film. Some of them are two-hour films. I only got three.
Yeah, yeah.
And I go back, and I guess if it came to a desert island thing, it'd be Laurel and Hardy and Chaplin,
well,
early
you
Chaplin.
You know, I sort of agree with you. Now, I have in my book, and you tell me if you rate it as highly as I do, but The Music Box is the Laurel and Hardy picture I chose.
Yeah.
I just, you know, every time I see it, I laugh.
Yeah.
But, you know, you're the kind of person this book was written for, because I think there are a lot of people who maybe do not go to see many new movies, but love the old movies, and they use Turner Classic Movies, they tape. You may be subscribed to Netflix. You've got a good local video store. And people are rediscovering the qualities of movies that were made sometimes before they were born.
Yes. One other point, and I'll get off, because I could talk about this for hours, is I've had people say, well, what do you go to Hollywood movies for? Have you ever gone to a high school drama play?
Yeah.
And they say, well, yeah. I says, the worst of the movies have good actors and actresses, but a high school play have rotten actors and actresses. And it's just a thing, you know. I mean, somebody may just have a bit part, but my God, they're good at it. You know, I that's always intrigued me. Never known anybody, you know, got to Hollywood. Known a few people got to Broadway in small stints, you know. But there's a certain thing about those people in those movies. I wish I knew what it were, but they're incredible. I just absolutely don't care at all about movies made today. I don't go to the movies now. I go to my old cabinet and pull out, you know, I pull out $13.99 and see what's on it, you know.
Yeah,
if I don't like the film, I just, you know, fast forward and go to something I have.
Where do you keep all those tapes? Do you have a problem in the house?
that's a sore point.
I bet it is.
So many bookcases in this house, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Do you have a wife?
Right now I'm working on perhaps I've got to look into legalities of giving some of the things to IU so they can digitize them for their media programs.
That would be helpful.
Bloomington.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm in the process of moving the things down to my daughter's home who lives down in Bloomington.
Yeah.
And I guess they're very much interested in it. It's great that some kid 20 years from now can look at a Laurel Hardy thing that you may never be able to find. I don't know
it would be a terrible thing to lose those films, wouldn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I'll hop off, because I could say I could talk and talk and talk. And thanks a lot.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Well, David Thompson, have you seen anything lately that you'd recommend?
Well, yeah, I liked one or two films last year. I'm a fan of Slumdog Millionaire. I thought that it had fantastic energy and novelty, and it was a very intriguing combination of Bollywood themes and people and places with old Hollywood musical ideas. And I know the first time I saw that film, when it was really a dark outsider, and when it was not doing any business at all, I saw it at a film festival way back last fall. I said, I think that film is going to figure this year because I think audiences will love it. So I liked that. I liked The Reader. I admired that very much. Now, that's a very serious, very solemn film. I liked a film that came out last year in the middle of the year with Ben Kingsley and Penelope Cruz called Elegy, if you remember it. A small film. Didn't get much attention. I thought it was very good. I thought 2007, the previous year, was a better year. But you know, I sort of agree with what our caller just said. I think that the new movies, on the whole, are not as interesting as the old movies, and I understand entirely that people might like to spend their time with stuff from long ago.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting when I went to see Slumdog Millionaire that the theater was full and it captured everyone.
There you are. You know, I mean, some people say it's got some very violent scenes and frightening scenes, and it does, but there really is a quality of fairy tale to it. And I agree with you. I think more or less people of all ages are enjoying the film. And, you know, Warner Brothers absolutely turned that film down. And it's probably, as we speak, it's just about passing the $100 million mark of income at the American box office. And that's a very telling thing, because sometimes the companies that seem to run the business, they don't really know what the audience want.
Let's take another call. A listener in Urbana joins us now on line one. Good afternoon.
This is a nice program. I agree with the man that called earlier that I've been watching movies my whole life as a kid, and I'm older now, and I agree that the older movies are a lot more interesting. I mean, in your book, do you have something like romantic comedies like Girl Friday and Bringing
His
Up
Girl
Day?
Friday.
Yeah.
I'm pleased to tell you, His Girl Friday is one of my all-time favorite films.
Don't you think that it's full of just great actors?
I mean, you can't take your eyes off of it. It's magnificent. The acting, the speed with which it moves, the quality of the dialogue.
Oh, my.
And I love romantic comedies, screwball comedies. And I just love pictures from that period, the late 30s and early 40s,
you
will find that period and that kind of film dealt with at length in this book. Yes.
And, you know, they didn't have to use a lot of violence, a lot of...
It's true.
Of things that they have to use today, it seems.
I know.
You could watch a movie and just enjoy every bit of it, and it wouldn't have anything hardly in there that's going to offend you.
Well, I think you're dead right, and I think also, you know, that we've lost the skill of writing that kind of dialogue.
Oh, that dialogue just goes fast, and there's so many like that. One's with Katharine Hepburn, one with Betty Davis.
Cary Grant, Betty Davis,
Katharine Hepburn,
Tracy.
All of those fine actors that...
We've got some very good actors around today, but I don't think we've ever passed the quality of the people of that generation.
No, and the writing. You know, maybe I think if we had the writers, maybe some of these actors could do it, you know.
Well, you know, one of the problems is that movie going today has become much more an entertainment for kids, people in the 15 to 25 year age range. And the theory is that those people don't appreciate and listen to dialogue. So the films are full of noise, explosions, car chases, crashes, gunfire. Because in theory, the business says that's what young people like. Now, I don't think it's necessarily true. I think there are plenty of young people around who, if you tell them a funny line, they get it. And they will laugh at it. And why not have more films that do that?
My granddaughter loves them all, too. And she's
There you are.
What is the name of your book again? Have You Seen? Okay.
Yes.
I might get that, because I really
like
hope
you will.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you for the call. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. If you'd like to talk with our guest, David Thompson, film historian and critic, his latest book on the movies, Have You Seen? A Personal Introduction to 1,000 Films. We'll take another call now. A listener in Champaign on line two. Hi.
Oh, good afternoon. Hey, I wanted to dissent from the prevailing opinion that everything new is extremely terrible, specifically in regards to two fields. One is animation. I think we're really in a new golden age of animation, especially with Pixar. And there are also a few new studios that are starting up, the new old-fashioned actual stop-motion was used to make this film Coraline, which I saw and greatly enjoyed. And and then you have other studios out there, Aardman Animations, who made the famed Wallace and Gromit series.
I love Wallace and Gromit,
All of those wonderful new studios out there who are telling some really enjoyable stories that can't be done in traditional ways.
You make a very very good point, and I don't want to seem to be saying that all new films are extremely terrible, to quote you. I go to the cinema all the time, and I constantly look forward to going, and I love to see the new films, and I'm always hopeful they're going to be great. I agree with you that this is a wonderful age for animation, and I should have included WALL-E as a film last year that I loved. It would not have troubled me at all if WALL-E had been nominated for Best Picture. I think it was quite a profound movie and carried a lot more weight than a lot of animated films do. And you're quite right. Pixar have revolutionized the business. The old days when an animated film was almost always Disney, those have passed, and a lot of brilliant young animators are at work now, and I think it's something we're still doing wonderfully.
I'm glad to hear you say that. It just seemed that sometimes it overly fetishized the past a few ways up. Mm. And I did have another question for you. I've done a lot of looking around, and I cannot find to see whether there has been a biopic of the romance between Douglas Fairbanks and Mary Pickford.
And it has never been treated in the movies. And
it's extraordinary to me because, I mean, it has a lot of those classic elements that Hollywood really enjoys, you know.
Well, it's a good point. There's a very interesting new biography of Fairbanks just come out, a book, and I don't know whether it will bring back the films, but yes, they were, you know, they were probably in their moment, apart from Chaplin, the most famous people in the world in the 20s, and both of them adored by the public, and it's a very interesting idea for a subject. You ought to, I suggest you start writing a screenplay yourself.
The idea has occurred to me a couple of times, but that would be quite a step. Another interesting aspect of it, and I'll end on this point, is that the two of them, along with Chaplin, if I remember right, and D.W. Griffith, founded United Artists.
You are absolutely correct. And, you know, Mary Pickford had the reputation of being the best business person of them all. She was a very, very shrewd businesswoman, and once she had passed the age where she could really be in films, she took a huge interest in the business affairs of United Artists.
I read very briefly that Mary Pickford is actually the producers of Sunset Boulevard initially approached her and then were literally sitting down to lunch with her and realized she would be horribly, horribly offended by the idea of playing woman.
Yeah.
So,
she was the first idea for Norma Desmond. Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for the call. So I wonder how this gentleman, if he did write a screenplay, how he would pitch it and to whom he would pitch it.
Well, that's always the big problem. Yeah. And every screenwriter, even screenwriters at the top, I think, have this problem. You have to get to L.A. somehow, and you have to have contacts. You need an agent. And you need someone who can get you in to see a producer or a star, and you need to be able to tell a story in a way that makes people excited, and it's a great skill. And everyone's always afraid of everything until they actually see it. So you're going to be battering your head against a wall, but you know, good films get made, and I don't think it's a crazy idea to do Fairbanks and Pickford. If you remember about 10, 15 years ago, Robert Downey Jr. played Chaplin. Mm. Now, the film as a whole, I think, did not work perfectly. There were some problems in it. But Downey was wonderful as Chaplin. And you know, that was pretty unexpected casting. And it's interesting to think who could play Mary Pickford and Douglas Fairbanks now. Johnny Depp maybe could be Fairbanks. Mm. Pirates.
Arg. It is when we are children that we fall in love with the movies. That's when we're first exposed to them. What movies did you love as a boy growing up?
Well, I was pretty generous in the sense that I just loved going to the movies. And I loved most things I saw. But probably the first film I ever saw was Olivier's Henry V, which I did not understand. I couldn't understand the language. But I could understand the battles and the horses and the armor and the arrows. And I love that film still. But pictures I did understand and really loved, a couple that stay in my mind, Meet Me in St. Louis, Judy Garland musical, and Red River, the John Wayne Western. Those are films I treasure deeply. And you know, I saw them probably when I was 6 or 7 or 8, that kind of age. And I keep seeing them, and I've seen them more times than I can count.
What leads you back to a film?
What takes me back?
Yeah, what leads you back? Why do you go and say, oh, I'm going to watch this again?
Well, it's probably the feeling I had very early on that if I'd loved a movie, I wanted to see it again straight away. And people always said to me, well, why do you want to see it again? You know the story. You know how it comes out. And I said, or tried to say, it's not the story, it's just the experience. I mean, it's almost like taking a warm bath. You know what a hot bath is like, but you still want to take another, don't you?
Yeah.
And for me, movies were like a hot bath. They were just a wonderfully sensual experience, and I loved the daydreaming and the fantasizing. So that's part of it. But as a person who has earned a living, more or less, writing about films, I find it fascinating to see how they date. Some films date a lot. You know, there are films that you saw when you were young, and you see them 20, 30 years later, and they're not as good. They're not the same. But then others get better. So it's a very interesting phenomenon. And also, it's a way of remembering your past, you know? I mean, you see an old film, and time and again, I say, oh, I remember, I saw that with so-and-so at the Majestic, a theater that's probably been torn down long ago. But you remember a place, and you remember an old friendship, and you remember a time of your life. And I don't know, I think that films can bring the past back like that.
Was it possible to go often to the movies in London during the war?
Well, yes. I mean, where I lived, we were within easy walking distance of 3 movie theaters, big theaters, what would be called movie palaces today. And they usually played a film and changed it every week. So you could see 3 new films a week easily. And sometimes they would change the program midweek. There were a lot of films in those days, and yes, it was easy to go to them. I mean, obviously, during the war, there was the danger of air raids, and if there was a siren blowing, then you took cover. But it was the time in Britain where I was born, but it was absolutely true in this country too. More people went to the movies in America. In 1945, 1946, the business was selling 90 million tickets a week. That's on a population that was probably half the size of the population today. And today, we sell about 20 to 25 million tickets a week. That gives you an idea of just how powerful a medium and an entertainment the movies were in those days.
Did you go often with your mom?
Yes, I went with any relative who would take me.
Yeah.
But you know also, I started very early going on my own. My mother had to go to work, and in the school holidays, I would, when I was 8 or 9, I would go to the theater, and if the film had a rating that meant I was too young to see it, I would ask strangers to take me in. And I was not alone. A lot of kids did that. And in those days, that was regarded as perfectly safe. I think if people knew your kid was doing it today, you'd be in trouble, because it's regarded as a much more dangerous world. The worst that happened to me was that I ate too much ice cream. An old lady insisted I go out with her afterwards and eat ice cream. But I very often got into movies like that.
Oh. It reminds me, when I was a kid, my father gave me $20, and he dropped me and a couple of my friends off at the theater. And we went in, and I thought, I've got $20 in my pocket.
Yeah.
And I didn't know he was expecting change. But boy, we had a lot of candy.
I bet.
Good and plenty.
Yeah. Kids don't generally understand the concept of change. I have to say with my own kids, and I say, change? And they say, no, I haven't changed.
Didn't you give this to me?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Well, I have not yet read your memoir, Try to Tell the Story.
Yeah.
But I have read a couple of reviews, and they're very good. And they mention your mom. She must have been quite a person. You want to tell us just a little bit about her?
Well, she was extraordinary. I should say, first of all, that my father left us when she went into the nursing home to have me. That was in 1941. He left us. He came back occasionally, but basically we were on our own. And, you know, this was at first in the wartime. Our house was hit by bombs a few times. There was real danger around, yet I never felt exposed to danger. And I think that has to be because of the skill with which she protected me. And I never felt that we were in a deprived home because my father wasn't there. And again, I think that was because she made it seem like a full, busy, crowded home. And she encouraged me in my schooling, but she encouraged me in movies too. A lot of parents are very uncertain when their kids go to the movies a lot. She just made one proviso. I could go to the movies, but I had to write one review a week of a movie I'd seen.
Hmm.
Look how I ended up. You know, I mean, she had enough forethought to see that I needed to do something with it and develop it. And she was a gentle, quiet, calm, kind woman, not highly educated, but with enormous practical common sense. And although I could have grown up feeling that I had been handicapped by not quite having a father, she gave me so much love that I never felt I needed more. So, you know, she allowed me to be a person. Mm. What more could you say?
Mm. Writing reviews as an 8-year-old.
No. That was a little bit later.
A little bit later. Okay.
That would have been 12 or 13.
13, okay.
Yeah.
You know, now we have about 100 years of film.
Yeah.
When did people first, who were the first film reviewers?
It's a great question. The film reviewers go back at least to the sort of the years just before the First World War. When the movies began, films were very short, and they were not easily reviewed in that they were little bits of action, they were jokes, and so on and so forth. But just before the First World War, and very much influenced by things going on in Italy, the country that really started to make long films, this country, and particularly D.W. Griffith, began to make long films, and Birth of a Nation is the famous first, because it was a 3.5-hour film, and people had to watch it in a quite different way from the way they had watched films before. And, of course, it was so big that a lot of people started writing about it. And I think that writers and newspapers generally realized that film was shaping people. It was a new level of discourse and information, entertainment, and it was as if the world of books had been suddenly magnified, and you had this whole new medium, and people were going to be different because of it. They were seeing things rather than reading about them. There was a lot of concern. A lot of people were very alarmed, and they thought that kids would go to the devil because of it, you know, that kind of thing. But that's really the moment, I think, that the writing about films begins seriously.
In the introduction to Have You Seen, you make this statement: if you haven't read much else, then Ian Fleming's Goldfinger may be the best book you've ever read. And you say that in the context of talking about foreign films.
Yeah.
Why is that one part of our of film literacy that we're short on?
Well, I think because we're naturally lazy, and I think that people so love the movies, that they so love the ease of it, that they find subtitles a bit of an intrusion and a little bit difficult. And this was not always the case. You go back to the 60s and the 70s, far more foreign language films played in America than play today. And one of the things I do in this book, because it isn't just a book about American film, it's about international film, is I try to stress and remind people of the great work that has been done in so many other countries: France, Germany, Japan, Italy, Sweden, Britain, many others. You know, all of those countries have had great filmmaking traditions. And yes, it is subtitled. And you have to work a little bit harder, maybe. And obviously the idiom in different countries can seem strange. Japanese films can seem very alien at first. But then you see a film like Seven Samurai, and you realize that the Japanese have an extraordinary love of film and a great talent with it. So I'm trying to get people to go back to foreign films and to give them another chance. And I think that just as people are rediscovering the past with American films, they can rediscover foreign films too.
Where do you recommend we begin an exploration of international film? What films would top the list?
Well, I mean, you can be systematic. You can start with Albania, but that's not a very promising way to go. The Albanian cinema is not one of the greatest. I would say, I think an American could start with English cinema, because the language is the same, and yet it's a bit different. And the subject matter and the attitudes are different. You can start with French cinema. I would say go back to the director Jean Renoir, who was the son of the famous Impressionist painter, who worked really from the 20s through to about 1960. An extraordinary body of work. The French New Wave. François Truffaut is a good person to start with. In Japan, Kurosawa and Mitsuguchi. I mean, go to your video store, ask about those films, see what they've got. If you've never seen Seven Samurai by Kurosawa and Living by Kurosawa, two very, very different films, but I think would be available in most video stores, try those two. One is an epic battle film. One is a very simple story about an old man who discovers he has not long to live. They're both immortal films, great works. And, you know, they are like the threshold to Japanese cinema, that there are hundreds of films beyond them that are worth seeing, too. Italian cinema, look at Fellini, look at Antonioni, look at Bertolucci, Rossellini. Sometimes trying it by directors is a good way. Just pursue one director for a time. But, you know, there are lots of ways to go, and you've got a lot of time, so there's no need to feel you're in a rush over it.
All right. Let's take another call, a listener in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hi. Talking about foreign movies and directors, Lena Wertheimer, actor Giancarlo Giannini, and the movie Seven Beauties, I think one of the great movies of all time.
Yep, that's a good one. And you know, there are so many different ways of making films. I think that's one of the things that foreign film teaches us. America has its own set genres, and they work well. But people in different countries have discovered quite other ways, and they're very refreshing sometimes.
The caller still there? No. Okay. Well, thanks for the call this afternoon. We have a few minutes remaining in this portion of the afternoon magazine. Our guest today, film historian and critic David Thompson, author most recently of Have You Seen? A Personal Introduction to 1,000 Films, and a memoir, Try to Tell the Story. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, if you'd like to join us, give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We take another call from a listener in Urbana. Line 2, hi.
Hi, I'd like to put a plug in for some of the films by Ousmane Sembene from Senegal.
Yeah.
He died recently.
Yeah.
The images from Moulade keep coming to my mind. It made such an impression on me. And,
well,
are you familiar with that film?
Oh, yes, yeah. There's a whole continent that really, until recently, has not figured that much in film history. But I think it's beginning to be recognized and felt. And Sembene is a master. And I think that there are probably other people there, too. And I think that it would amaze me, for instance, if we did not start to see fascinating films coming out of Iraq. I think that the turmoil that country's been through will lead to some fascinating films. Iranian film has been for 10 or 15 years one of the most interesting cinemas in the world. And I think that every newly developing country in its turn discovers cinema and does something new and brilliant with it. But yes, I think that African cinema is well worth a following.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Are there magazines or resources online that you would recommend where we could begin to learn more about this director? I've never heard of him before, Sembene.
Well, you know, there is a wonderful website called IMDb.com, International Movie Database, I think is what it stands for. And you can look up on that any actor, any director, any cameraman, virtually anybody involved with the movies, and quickly get a complete list of the films they've made. It's a wonderful way of building a list for yourself of films you might see. There are books, too, I might add, and I've done some of them. I don't want you to forget the books. But the websites on film are very helpful, and IMDb is the biggest, probably. But there are plenty of others. And if you're unaware of these people, if they're new names to you, it may be a very good way to track them down.
Hmm. Is there anything that you're looking forward to seeing, say, this weekend at the movies?
I'm always looking forward to the next movie I'm going to go see. I, 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 I still love, as I did as a child, sitting down, the lights go down, and the screen bursts into light. I love mm-hmm. that moment, and I always hope that something extraordinary is going to come.
Mm. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon, David Thompson.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
David Thompson is the author most recently of Have You Seen? A Personal Introduction to 1,000 Films. And he is the author also of the memoir Try to Tell the Story, both books published by Knopf.